Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
When you start a book, is that where you start with the idea that, gee, it would be fun to lop off people's heads and spill their guts? So I think I'll write Viking. Or do you now think of where something, what an area you haven't yet explored? What is the first seed of a novel?
You want the truth. Okay, the
I can't handle the truth, but you...
She can't handle the truth!
All right. Used to be, say up to about book 50. Anyway, I usually have ideas. Oh, I want to do a book.
I love the way you casually toss that one off. Up until book 50.
I always have an idea, you know, that let's do this. And then I became more plot light. And then basically it was a what-if idea. For example, in the FBI series, has anybody read the FBI series? Why isn't every hand up? If you're sitting next to somebody who did not raise their hand, I'm counting on you to see to this. The level of discipline is up to you. Anyway, a what-if idea. For example, in the third book of the FBI series, I had no clue what to do. And so what if I did was, what if we have this guy, I don't know who he is, I don't know what he is, I don't know why he is in the Rockies in Colorado, I just know he's there to get away from something, okay? And what if one day he's out chopping wood and he finds this little girl in the forest who's been physically and sexually abused? What happens? And that's how almost all my books begin, is if with a what-if idea. And if there is not a what-if idea, which I just started the 23rd book, have absolutely no freaking clue. I was thinking, well, let's bring back Griffin Hammersmith because he hasn't been front and center in a book, and he's in the FBI back with Savage. And so I started the book, and I put it back in this town where I know it's really in Podunk, Western Virginia. So we're talking bumfuck here. And so he had friends there, so he's there to visit, and then we have all this stuff happened. And so I send them an outline, because contractually I have to, after about 100 pages when I have an idea of what the book might be about. And I really have no idea. So an idea, what happens is, and if people say, oh, well, I'm waiting for an idea to hit. No, honey. You sit there and you write. It does not matter if it's crap. It does not matter. I have never been able personally to edit a blank page. All right? But if what you write is sheer garbage, it does not matter because it gives your brain, then goes to work on it. Well, hey, wait a second, that's not bad. What if I did? No, that doesn't work. How about this? How about that? So if you're driving on the highway and I'm coming there, pull over. All right. So that's kind of how it goes. Now, neither Lori nor I are outliners. Which means a lot of what we call backward buildup. In other words, your brain goes to work on the crap you wrote that day, and then the next day, you're rewriting it. You're adding all this wonderful stuff. Well, you're going to be rewriting up to 3 and 4 times one chapter, maybe even going back, because you're changing, constantly changing, because there is no outline to follow. Interestingly enough, the second series I co-write with J.T. Ellison, A Brit in the FBI. Has anybody read those books? This is not as good. This is very disappointing. Those of you in need of discipline, there's not enough people to do it. All right, tell you what, after signing the book, the sixth book, just, my goodness, no, it's the fifth book. It just came out. It's set in London. There are international thrillers. Very James Bondy, a lot of fun, very high technical stuff. Anyway, it's there, so if you haven't read it, I would expect you, and I will sign it, and you will raise your right hand. anyway, but I remember what I was going to say. Interestingly enough, when JT and I are doing this, she's not a plot, she's not an outliner either. Do you know that we brainstorm ideas, brainstorm, you put two authors on something, and I don't know if you've ever done this, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. She thinks of things that would never have shown up on my radar, the same with me. So we get basically what the story's gonna be about, and we sit across from each other, and we outline from chapter 1 to chapter 95, each chapter in a row. We do it. We do it. I never thought it would be possible. She didn't either. We do it. And then she does the heavy lifting. She does the writing. We're talking every day, every day. And then the book comes back to me, and then I spend probably a month and a half on it because they're written, you know, under my name, so you're expecting my voice. And she does it very, very well, except she doesn't know, she doesn't do my dialogue, and I'm very dialogue heavy. So then I have to, you know, I redo all the dialogue and then this, that, and the other. But what's amazing about that is, again, two people who do not outline can do it. Probably separately we could not, but together, because it's always this spark. It's this magic spark. I just love it. Now, I understand, and I know that you have heard horror stories about writer partnerships. They tend to end in, putting it mildly, disaster. Very bad feelings. A couple of gunfights.
Stabbings.
Lord knows. But I had never... What happened... was, I can't even believe now, this was 2000. You want me to keep talking?
Please.
But we're kind of, okay, all right, all right. It was back in 2012, and I was traveling, and this whole family came into my brain. I mean, they're English, and their background, and Nicholas and his dad. I even had the butler. I knew all about the frickin' butler. I knew
Nigel.
Everything. Nigel. No, that's... It's Horn. Nigel is his son, and he is Nicholas's butler.
Oh, that's right. Oh,
that
sorry.
That was very close. Okay. That was very close. And his grandfather is Baron Deveshi, and he owns Delphi Cosmetics. I mean, the whole thing. But I could not write two big books a year. That's the bottom line. I could not do it. So I said, what am I going to do? Because these are wonderful, wonderful people. And so I said, well, everybody's co-writing. Everybody. So... I called up, who reads Clive Cussler? Okay, well, yeah. Well, Clive is a friend. So I called him, and he has a lot of co-writers, people who write for him. And I said, I want to do this. Tell me what to do. So he gave me his protocol, and he says, well, Catherine, I'm not cheap like Jimmy. That's Patterson. And believe me, he is. So I... anyway... So his protocol was really cool, and I had called my agent and told him about it. He says, oh, that's a great idea, and he owns the agency. And of course, he would say, well, Catherine, you know we have several people in-house who can do this with you. And I'm going, oh, shut up. And so my husband and I, we called, you know, like Poison Pen. We called people all over the country, got recommendations. I wanted somebody who was published in suspense thrillers. And we each got a pile of books, and we were reading them. And separately, this is no lie, separately, we picked the same person, J.T. Ellison. I had never read her before. I'd never heard of her. I knew nothing about her. I did know that she was a female because of her picture on the back. So at this point, I was so naive, I didn't realize that doing this means this. It means utter, utter intimacy. And I wasn't thinking about it. I just wasn't thinking about it because I was so excited. So I called my agent. Guess what? She's at his agency. Her agent.
Agreed.
Her agent I've known for years. So that cut out a lot of difficulty at all. I give her a call, flew her out to Sausalito, and almost instantly we're like this. Unfortunately, we look like Mutt and Jeff. If we have pictures taken together, she's squatted down, I'm on my tiptoes, and we still look kind of stupid. But anyway, She's a Republican. I'm a Republican. We're huge cat lovers. It's just absolutely amazing how we fit together. And the whole household loves her. And she'll be out twice a year where we're working on books and talking and blah, blah, blah. And as I say, we email. I know her family. She knows my family. We know everything about each other. So when you get into an association like this, A, you pray really, really hard that it's going to work. And I've been, thank you, God. I have been so, so lucky. And I think that she's very grateful too, because we worked very well together. Her books are also very, very good. J.T. Ellison, you can look her up. She's on Facebook. She was born with technology under her right armpit. I was born with it like under my toes. So she's really, really heavy on the technical part, which is excellent because I'm not. And then we do the plotting together and all this sort of stuff. And so that's worked out. Actually, she's now working. I was with her in February. And that's when we plotted The Last Second, which will be out in March of next year. And they take place like 2 weeks after the one in before. So five books, they've known each other 6 months, because he had to come over. His mom was American, even though he's a Brit. So he goes into the FBI. So we skip 4 months, 5 months while he's in the FBI. And then it's just boom, 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 boom. So they're a lot of fun. And if you were thinking, oh, please give me a chance on those, just give them a chance, because I think you'll really like him. If you like James Bond, if you lust after him, go for it. You're really going to like him.
Yeah, they really are fascinating, because you'd think when two people are writing a book that you would get a sense of these two different voices talking, sort of like a stereo thing going on. But it isn't. The voice that you have in those books is a single voice throughout. And yet it's neither you nor JT specifically. I mean, it feels like both of you.
Well, I'm actually every sentence. I'm actually in every sentence to make sure, because I don't want anybody ever saying, well, who wrote this book? You didn't. You know, so you want to really, really keep that close. So we're doing well. We'll see what happens. The books are not as popular yet as the FBI, but they're coming along. They're coming along. The publisher hasn't shot either of us, so that's a good thing.
That's always a good sign.
That's a very good thing. Okay, so that's how that second series started. I'm sorry. All right.
So when you are doing, I mean, I always find it baffling how people manage to outline anything or plan anything, because I...
But you can do it. You can do it.
There's voices. But how, when you are doing one of your own books, not the ones that you and JT plan out beforehand, how do you know when it's going someplace? Is it just that 80 books in, you know when it's not?
That's a really good question. I think it happened one time. I don't even remember the book. I had written maybe 85 pages, and it simply, boop! And it was not that I had writer's block. I do not believe in writer's block. There's no reason to believe in it. What it is a bad idea. And people are terrified to let go. Nope, throw the pages away and trust that another plot or whatever is going to come out of that parking lot in your brain. And it does. It simply does. So no, I do not believe in writer's block. I think you can get bored, and that's when you try something else. Trying a different genre is always a lot of fun. A lot of fun. It's a whole different mindset. It wakes up brain cells that have been dead for 20 years. And that's something. And they don't like cornflakes. But anyway, never mind. So what were you talking about?
I think that one of the things that I admire tremendously about you is the business-like approach that you take towards writing. And that idea of tossing out 85 pages is something that is very difficult to get across to new writers, is that if you are interested in producing a book, that's one thing. If you are interested in having a career as being a writer, the thing that you need to do is to keep writing.
Yes.
It's one of the drawbacks of self-publishing, that that you tend to get so fixated on the book that you have done, that you then have to find a publisher or self-publish it and then track its sales, and you have to promote it and everything else. And instead of thinking, where am I going to be in 30 years? You're thinking, oh, my sales are falling off of this particular book. I think that anyone who is able to produce two books a year by sitting down for 4 hours a day is focused in a way that that is hard to really get across, but is absolutely necessary for new writers.
I think one of the problems with somebody who starts out is they always say, well, write what you know. Well, come on, what is the internet? You can know anything you want, but let's not go there. What she meant and what she was talking about, I think, was that it becomes your baby. You know, your baby, I can't let my baby go. My baby is beautiful. And you're wrong. And that's the thing. It is a business. You want to feed the cats, okay? And then anything else about feeding the cats is gravy. But if you want to publish your baby, be my guest. But if you want to face it as a business, as the way you are going to support yourself, then it's not your baby. It's another idea, and let's do it as well as we can. And the Alexa, my goodness, Alexa, you would not believe what she knows. I mean, it's just marvelous. I had a 10,000 book library, a huge number of research books, and I'm culled down now to probably 100 books, okay? So there's just so much instant information. The book of your heart could probably be one book, but then it's just the book, anything that catches your interest. And it has to catch your interest for a period of time, okay? Because you can't write a book in a week. Although Sherilyn Kenyon says, well, if I don't get my 100 pages a week, I'm so depressed. And I sent her a bomb. 100 pages a week.
Yes. One of the things that I came across in some interview or other that you gave was a reference to plotting by chocolate, that you tend to fuel your idea mechanism with doses of chocolate. Is this the case?
No.
Okay. I did not
sleep with him. I don't know why you put that.
Yeah. I simply came across it, and I was going to ask a very deeply personal question of...
Did you sleep with him or not?
No.
No, I didn't.
I promised I wouldn't get personal, but, I mean, there are some things you just have to know, right? So, dark chocolate, milk chocolate, or white chocolate?
Milk chocolate.
Okay.
Who's milk chocolate? Oh, that's pathetic. How about dark chocolate? You're health nuts, aren't you? Oh, I should have known. Well, this is Berkeley. What did I expect?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
We will have duels outside.
Right. So, moving on from chocolate. So, you have... About how long does it take you to write your book? I mean, if you're sitting down and writing 3 or 4 hours a day,
maybe 6 months.
It's a 6 month thing.
Yeah.
And then do you do a rewrite, or have you just rewritten it as you go along the way?
No, I do another rewrite, and then it goes to my other half, and we have divorce court, and he is probably the best editor I have ever met in my life. He's a physician, so anything medical from Viking on is accurate. And I actually had some fan mail talking about, well, you wouldn't do this in this case. And I said, well, I'll tell my physician husband. No, and he's really the editor from hell. And then when it gets sent to my editor at Simon & Schuster, there's rarely anything to do, but she's very talented at her work, and she will always pick up on something. And people all, it's a huge, I cannot emphasize this enough. The book that's coming out in July, it's called Paradox, it's the 22nd FBI. I had gotten the galleys. Galleys are when they look like the printed page, and it's the last pass-through that I get as an author. And I go through it, and I found just so many problems. So I was writing like a fool. So many problems. Then it went back to them. They sent it back. They entered all those, sent it back. I wrote, I did more on it. And I thought, fine, finally. 3 days ago, I heard from the copy department, my copy editor, who is a goddess. She doesn't miss anything. And there were probably 80 pages with questions and queries, things that were inconsistent, things where I had used the same name again, how they were missed, I have no clue. Things that said, now, wait a second, in two books ago it was this. What about, you know, just totally anal, which is what you need in a copy editor.
Yep.
So now I don't have to worry about it. Now I do not have to worry about it. So it's a team effort. In fact, I'm throwing them a party on Monday. I do this every time a book comes out. For everybody, the mailroom. I mean, they send the stuff out, for heaven's sakes. It's totally, totally a team effort, which in self-publishing you do not get, which is scary, which is frankly scary. On the other hand, it gives you another whole option to get your work out there, so I think it's wonderful. But there are differences. There really are. But I'm very lucky to have great people.
Somewhere or other, I came across a mention that you were doing rewrites of some of your early Regency romances and making them into longer historical romances.
Yeah.
Can you say something about the difference in those two forms and the how you go about rewriting a book that is long off your table?
Well, the Regency romances were started by a British author. Her name is Georgia Heyer. Has anybody read Georgia Heyer? She's wonderful. She died in the early 70s, and her daughter-in-law would brag that she'd never read one of her books. Anyway, she's a fantastic writer. She started an entire genre of books. Mm-hmm. And so the Regencies are very stylized. They're about maximum 70,000 words. A normal book, not normal, but a book that I write now, like an FBI, is 100 to 110,000 words. Okay, so they're shorter books. And they're very stylized. I changed them a little bit. But when I started writing the historical romances, I've already done this. I did this a number of years ago. Changed the title, lengthened them, added humor. Duh, what a concept. And now they're much better. So if you have a choice and you want to read some of the early books, read the longer ones instead of the original Regencies because they're much more constipated.
Did you change the names, the titles?
Yes.
Yeah.
But I insist that you have both names on there because the last thing you want is for somebody to write you and say, well, I already read this book and you changed the title on me without saying it. No, 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 we don't do that. We don't do that.
Yes.
The houses love to do that, but we don't do that. You have to throw your weight around.
Do you have a problem with other publishers changing when you have a book that's published both in the U.S. and the U.K. that they've changed? That's a very common problem of having the same book with different punctuation and a different title.
I haven't run into that with either Ireland, Australia, or England. Of course, when you translate into like German or something, it's very strange. Very strange.
Yeah.
No, like the final cut came out to be, I don't know, The Dull Knife. I'm not sure. Something like that. Very strange.
Yeah. Your characters, you have a lot of fun with your characters. Can you say something about how you go about building them? Now, you've mentioned already a couple of them who basically just walked into your life. the British family that ended up coming here, the fellow who's just started talking in your ear and said, what about me? Dylan and Nicholas are main characters. Do all of your main characters come to you in that way?
Well, Savage.
Tell us about the voices in your head, Kate.
You see me coming? Move over. They're always working on what I've usually written that day. They're talking about, no, I don't like that. That really sucks, ma'am. Can you try something else? I mean, they're always blabbing. It's very interesting, too, anybody who writes, and I know this is true with you, but a character has to have the correct name, or they will sit down and stare at you and not move. I am not lying. This is true. In the book I just started, for example, usually I'll introduce new characters. So you have, you know, Sherlock and Savage are the thread who run through them, and then you have another mystery with two different characters, and they all kind of work together. Sometimes they dovetail, sometimes they do not. Anyway, her name, she was in deep caca, okay? Really deep caca. We start out with her being duct-taped, somebody smacked her on the head in a basement. And so I said, well, okay, your name is Corey. No. So I said, okay, let me see here. I went through names. One thing that's really cool, too, is like Mystery Writers of America or Romance Writers of America, all the membership lists, you go down names. How about this one? How about this one? And then 2 nights ago, I finally dreamed a name, and it was Claire. Claire. Okay. So the next day I wrote, okay, Claire. And there was no hint of anything. So I kept going, and then the second time, I am not lying to you, the second time I typed her name, Claire did not come out of my fingers. Carson did. Carson is her name. This has never happened before, and I am going to see a doctor about it. Don't weird things like this happen?
Spirit possession is definitely a thing, yeah.
But these things happen. I mean, they just happen out of the blue. Mm. The hick sheriff, I had named him Booker. And then I dreamed about the Bodines. And his name was Bodine. It wasn't Booker. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. So it's fun. It's always a journey, and you never know what's going to happen. Oh, and then the mail comes. That's probably one of the most exciting points in the day for a writer, because you never know what's going to be in there. You know, it could be a sale to Israel. You don't know. It's always exciting. Or another bill.
Spam. My postman doesn't deliver anything interesting. They just spam.
Well, and before the email and so forth, you would get lots of fan mail. You know that now that's rare, and it's always from county prisons, city prisons, state prisons, federal prisons. I know them all. I have been propositioned by the best. The last one I got was an offer of $100 for a blowjob. And a lot of them are very good artists. I've had maybe...
I think you and I have a similar... yeah, I have this little collection of things that they sent me, and I didn't quite know how to send them back.
You're not going to send back art. You know, they drew your picture off the back cover, and, you know, there's some talent there. And everybody is innocent. Everybody.
Everyone is and misunderstood, which brings us to the corollary of your protagonist, and that's your villains. How do you shape a villain? Do they come ready-made like some of your protagonists have, or is that a slower process when you see what the protagonists are doing and you have to know what the villain needs to do to to wrap around it.
They evolve like the plot, like the story. They evolve. They go this way. No, that doesn't work. They go a different way. And then they find the right way to go. Hopefully it's the right way. Thank you. Thank you if it is.
Are you aware of how the protagonists and the villains fit together as you're doing it? Are you consciously aware of it, or is that something that just comes along?
That's something that it evolves.
Yeah.
It evolves.
Yeah, it really is fascinating how the process of not outlining and not being deliberate will nonetheless give you things that really work together.
And things that you never would have thought of in a million years. Because if you're outlining, you're going along a certain path and you're kind of forcing things. Now, writers do not use an outline as a Bible. They do not. They diverge, but it's kind of like the backbone to them. And I love backbones. I just don't do well with them, except with JT. Mm-hmm. But the villains, I remember in Nemesis, where Sherlock gets the terrorists in JFK, and then she takes down the terrorist at the Lincoln Memorial, I guess. That was very interesting because the terrorist she brought down, I had no clue what he was about when I had it happen. I had no clue what he was about. Well, the way it unwound is you felt so bad for him. You felt so bad because of what they'd done to him. And it's amazing what happens. Now, would I have thought of that in an outline? Probably not. But it came, a lot of people like to say, well, it's organic, and I think of eggs. But it's more organic because it's always changing and growing and going one way that you can look at and think, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, or no, no. So I like the way we do it.
Yeah. Yeah,
which is good since I can't do it the other way.
A friend and I co-wrote a how-to book on writing crime and thrillers, and she's a very, very much the outliner, and so we started out and gave each other our first sample chapters, and basically she started out by saying, anyone who doesn't outline is just stupid. And I started out by saying that anyone who outlines is totally anal. And so we looked at each other and said, maybe it's something to tone it down a little. So we came up with that she is the organized writer and I was the organic writer. So, it allows you to sort of not put a value judgment on these stupid anal overly fixated on controlling. I also think that it's kind of like those tests that they gave you in high school where you had a little drawing and you were supposed to guess what the back of them looked like. And I think that someone who outlines will get those questions right, whereas you or I would have to make it out of wire and turn it around and look at it. So, it's just fascinating the way the writer's mind works and how the writer's mind doesn't work. Now, as you go into your different 83 books, you're going to find areas that you don't know and things that are tough to find out. Now, as you say, you can substitute a lot of those arcane books that are on your shelf. You can actually do research online. Even 10 years ago, it was more difficult than not. You'd find yourself in a dead end, and the most you could come up with was an expert that you could write to about something. But when you are starting a book that you know is going to be heavy research, at what point do you bring that in?
There's a rule of thumb for research, which I found is true, that you will know so much about the subject. You will know so much about it. You start by using 10% of what you know, and you cut it down from there. Because your primary focus is to distract and entertain. If you teach along the way, you give fun little nuggets of information, go for it. But you have to be, you've read books where they go on and on, look at what I know, you idiot, and you don't know it, but now I'm trying to tell you about it. You know, you want to throw them across the room. Your job as a fiction writer is to entertain. You know, if your husband or your wife is in surgery, you're sitting out there in the waiting room, open a book and distract yourself. And that's what my job is, and that's what Lori's job is to distract you and entertain you. And yeah, you got to know a whole bunch of stuff about what you're talking about, but the reader doesn't need to. They don't need to. Just enough to give verisimilitude. That's the key. When you get the verisimilitude button, then stop.
Do you have a community of experts that you call on for various things?
JT does. She has her alpha mates. And her dad was a biggie at Boeing, so he knows all about flying. So anytime we use airplanes, everything goes by him. And then she has a medical examiner do all of the bodies, make sure she gets that right. She has someone who reads for only plot points. She has a whole group of people, her beta mates, she calls them. And I wish I had that, but I don't.
I always find that when I'm, for example, in yours, in the Final Cut, you have
in the dull knife.
in the far from dull knife. Yes. I was just envisioning you wandering around in the Metropolitan Museum asking really awkward questions on security. Because the plot turns on the theft of the Kohinoor from the Met, and you sort of think, how far do you go with asking those awkward questions before people are saying, why do you want to know?
It's all online. And if to add that extra bit of verisimilitude, I know that JT talked to the director of the Met, and he sent her to their head of security, and she had not general questions, she had several specific questions. They are delighted to work with you. If I have an FBI question, I have my goddess at the FBI. For example, in Nemesis, we have a newborn kidnapped out of the nursery. I did not even know this, but now they have guards on maternity wards, okay? Mm-hmm. Also, they have little sensors in the baby's umbilical, and around their ankle. I didn't know this. Mm. I didn't know that they have a special team of FBI agents that are not kidnapped victims. They're out of nurseries and hospitals. They're called the CARD team. What does that stand for? C. Anyway, the CARD team. I knew nothing about it. She put me in contact with the supervisor of the CARD team, told me everything they did. They are delighted to help you. Delighted. I have never run into anyone who was a jerk face. Well, you don't need to know this. Go away. Die. No. Everybody, I remember she was telling me, she said, I had to call Patterson and say, no, you can't do that. And I call her up and I say, okay, I need to do this. This person is coming in through the guest entrance into the Hoover building, and they need to leave an envelope. How can I do this? Can I do it this way? No, you cannot. And everybody got on the phone, and we figured out how it could have happen. That was according to the rules. Everybody is eager to help you. If you are, all right, I should not be so quick on that. If you are not published, you may have a bit more difficulty.
I was just going to say, you can always hold up a book and say, yeah, I really use this.
All anybody can do is say no. And I've never been shy. You probably think so. But really, all anybody can do ever is say no. And I've had no said to my face in the past. Who cares? You just go to somebody else. Somebody will tell you what you need to know. It's better to get said no to a couple of times than guess at something. Now, if it comes to a bureaucratic question with the FBI, I always pick the thing that is not common sense, because it is bureaucracy. And that's usually correct.
Yeah, and it's extremely rare for writers to have their their doors knocked down because of their online searches.
It has happened, but the writer was asking for it. Just like, and I think they were doing it partially on purpose to see how far they could go before there was a red light and somebody was knock, knock, knock. Yeah, yeah. It didn't happen.
But it's okay. It's really rare. And just make sure you show people that you are actually writing a book. That'll help you a lot in court.
Did you know that the FBI has a unit, and the unit's responsibility is to know everything written about the FBI in the known universe? Okay? And so if you're a writer and you are writing about terrorism in Aleppo, in Syria, and you're getting really into this stuff, they're going to look at this because it's going to trigger things. They're going to, and they're going to look at this, and then they probably the first thing they're going to do is contact the information unit and say, oh, yeah, this is the writer. He or she writes blah, blah, blah. So it's done.
Social media. We're going to open it to questions in just a minute. Social media. You are lovely and interesting and regular on your Facebook page.
I guess I'm regular.
And well, like the other two, quite too. Are you aware of your community of readers as you, I mean, obviously when you're posting on Facebook, but in general, I mean, when you write a book, are you aware of how the community will react to it?
That's a good question. Sometimes, you know, Facebook is a very odd platform. I probably have around 100,000 followers. However, I post every day, talk every day to people. It will get out to maybe 7,000.
Yep.
Why? No clue. All right, then you need to boost, to pay money to boost. And it maybe gets out to 30,000 people. You know, when are you not on the list? I have no clue about this. But what happens is you get a regular core of maybe 50, 60 people who are on there every day. And I think what I am is a platform for them to talk to everybody else and see what's going on. You know, they know their lives. I'm a journal, is what I am. I provide the journal for them. And this is very, very true. Mm-hmm. I think that if you are completely interactive like I am on Facebook, then that's what happens. It's because they will always respond to what I write, and then they'll talk about what they're doing, and people's comments to them will be usually about what they're doing. You know, so it's a very interesting phenomenon, the whole Facebook thing. Mm-hmm. And of course, this idiot needs to go to. Never mind. Just not talk about it. I mean, Yahoo did not go to jail. Never mind.
That most of them are Yahoos, but yes. So, with the variety of subgenres that we started talking about between the Vikings and the medievalists and the American 19th century, is there anything? What sort of area are you looking to go into? And is there anything that you would not want to write? I mean, you've only got 83 books. Surely you're headed for
Roberts. I am a duffer.
Yeah,
duffer. I've never had an idea for a science fiction, but I wouldn't say no. I mean, writing is writing is writing is writing. I mean, if you get an idea, go for it. Go for it. Well, let me.
I'm not arguing with you, but you are.
It was very, very interesting when I had written straight historical romances up until 1989, when I was then 15. And again, off traveling, and this whole plot came to me, but it was contemporary. And so I don't know why I had a brain inspiration, but I didn't open my mouth. I went home and I was working on the third historical romance of a contract. and it was due in 3 weeks. No, it was due in 2 months. And I went home, and to buy myself time to write this without telling anybody, I finished that book in 6 weeks. This was 25 pages a day, which is, that happens once in a lifetime. And so then I simply wrote the book. Didn't say a word to anybody, and then sent it to the publishing house, and they said, what? And then they went nuts over it. And they wanted to bring it out in hard, they brought it out in hardcover. And they did a nice, modest, I think, 20,000 print one, which then was modest. Now that would be amazing, given e-books are up there, yeah. You know. I mean, everybody, print books are dying on the vine, but let's not go there with this. And so it did very well. And so then what I started doing was interspersing the contemporaries, and this was not a suspense thriller. It was a romantic suspense. In other words, to have the word romance in there, you have to have that at the core, at the center of the book, the relationship between the man and the woman. Then anything else you want around there, spirits, ghosts, conundrums, mysteries, anything is around here. So they were romantic suspenses. And they did very well. I think there were 4 of them. And then it was steady on with the historical romances, and they were like trilogies, 3 at a time. And in 1995, I just finished 9 books in 3 years. And that's the first time I was kind of burned to my heels. And that's when my sister, who's never done this in her life, we were at a family reunion in Texas. She comes trotting up to me and she said, have you ever heard of a little town in Oregon called The Cove? They have the world's greatest ice cream and bad stuff happens. So that's when I went to publish, and I said, I want to write this book. And of course, I understand where they were coming from. If it ain't broke, why fix it? They wanted more history. I said, nope, I'm going to do it. So I just stuck in my heels. And so when I finished the book, it was a whole new change. It was a suspense thriller, a totally new genre. And they wanted to put it in hardcover. And that would have been fine, except if you change genres and you go on hardcover, the last thing you want to do is fail in hardcover. Failing in something else, who cares? But you don't want to fail in hardcover. So I talked them out of it. And this was The Cove. It came out in 1996, and whoever did the cover went to bed with so many different people because it was so excellent. You see, you know, a cover really hits the right note when it's copied by all the other houses. This cover was copied for 3 years. And it did amazingly well. And that's when they said, well, when's the next one? Well, there wasn't a next one. As I said, that was my sister wasn't there with the next one. But that's when, you know, Dylan Savage spoke up and got his Orion, which stayed in the water, incidentally. Thank you. And Quinlan, who is the FBI, why did I make him an FBI agent? I don't know. It seemed sexy at the time. I had no clue what it even meant. Barely. And he appears in a couple of other books. One thing I think people like about series, which I like about series, is you get to see the same people over and over, and you get to see their lives and how they change and what happens and so forth. And then you add new people, and they get, put into the cake mix. And I enjoy that in a series. I very much miss Sue Grafton, and I'm sure we all do. God, I hate cancer. Anyway. So, but everybody likes series, right? Yeah. So that's how that started. And so another new genre like science fiction. I don't want to do a Western. I'm sorry. I just can't because there's nothing to do. There's nothing to do that has not been done.
No return to the horse ranch for you.
No return to the horse ranch.
Okay.
There's nothing to do. They try. On Westworld, I mean, they bring the robots to life. Fine.
Well, I'm personally looking forward to seeing the Catherine Coulter futuristic novel. I'm looking for that. I'm all
give
over.
Me an idea.
Okay. So let us ask questions, and I think we have a mic over there. Yes, if you because
well, you guys got big mouths. We don't need a mic, do we? All right.
Uh, I have to say that I was first introduced to you through your romance novels, so I'm curious as to what motivated you to switch. Not that I'm upset that you switched, but what motivated you to switch from romance novels to another genre?
Well, I told you about, I got the idea for that first from my sister, for the thriller. On the other hand, for years and years, I would write one FBI and one historical romance because, and I was telling Lori earlier, they are two such disparate genres that it keeps your brain unconstipated. And I did that until maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 4 years ago. And then I want to smell the roses a little bit. And then we also do the novel with JT. So what I did, because people keep saying, when's there going to be a historical rom, blah, 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 blah. I have now written three novellas. The Sherbrookes were the most popular historical romance family. There were 11 books in the Sherbrooke, what do you want to call it, series. And so I took one of the sons, his name is Grayson Sherbrooke, and he writes ghost stories. So I took him, I said it when he's an adult, it's in 1841, and these are novellas, which means they're about 20, 22,000 words. And the third one is coming out this fall. And then, of course, they're an only ebook because they can't publish a paperback with a 20,000 word story in it. So, but they said, okay, once you have the third one in, then we'll put it in a paper, in a trade paperback, and sell it that way so it can go to people who like to read paper. So it's not that I switched off and stopped. No, 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 never, ever, ever. I love both genres tremendously. They both have different challenges. In terms of the biggest challenge, the FBI, because with a suspense thriller, unlike the historical romance, which is if I want to take you to a cat race, off we go to the cat races. But I can't do that in a suspense thriller. I've got to keep you turning the pages. So pacing becomes critical. Also, loose ends. Loose ends, they breed. There are two loose ends, and you look up, there are six! Oh! So that's why you need an editor from hell to make sure all those loose ends are got. But no, I love both genres. And again, I wouldn't mind creating a world for science fiction. It might be kind of strange.
I'm there.
I thought maybe you had a question. Yes, ma'am.
I'm always interested when authors and writers talk about the voices in their head, right? So I'm just curious about what is a awkward time that a character has chosen to speak to you?
Doesn't happen. It really doesn't happen. If you're with other people, it simply doesn't happen. I mean, they're off in the other room. Yeah.
Except you have mentioned that, you know, you occasionally will get an epiphany as you're driving and bounce around.
Well, that's not...
That's a little awkward.
You're by yourself.
Yeah.
That's awkward. But yeah, an epiphany while driving is a wonderful thing. Had one of those. It was wonderful. Wonderful. There was this cliff. Oh, my God.
I used to live back in the hills, and we had this... The town had a shop with a pizza parlor and two churches, and there was a stop sign. And every so often, the neighbors would find me sitting at the stop sign, the plot going, and that, and that, and that. And they learned to drive around me. Yeah. It's just Lori, she's working again.
So true, so true. Yes, sir.
What spurred you to write your first book?
Lived in Manhattan, started writing for Mr. Desiccation. You know, I don't remember his name, but I remember that he was desiccated. And my husband was a medical student in Columbia Presbyterian. So I saw him 30 minutes a day, basically, at dinner. And I was reading, I don't know, 15 books a week. And one night, I just threw the book across the room and said, I can do better. And I thought, oh, I am so special. Turns out maybe 60% of authors start that way. Can you believe? I had no clue, and I was told that by the publisher. I told my husband, he took the next weekend off, and the first and last book, and we plotted it. And it took me a year to write because I did have to work. And then I was very, very lucky. Very lucky. There are three reasons a publishing house will bring somebody on board. One is the book is so good, everybody's just having orgasms and they're dancing in the halls. Read this, read this, read this. But the more common reason is that over 80% of contracted authors who, let me add their own due dates, are late. Can you imagine they're late? I am never late. My books are scheduled out before I even know about them because you're dependable and they can trust me. So they're harried all the time. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And so I think that probably is what happened in my case. And I can't remember the third reason. Do you know the third reason?
Because they just fall in love with you as a person?
That's it. Well, it was fortunate living in New York because that was the center of publishing in the world. So that was very fortunate. I'll never forget. I took the A train down to Wall Street and met a guy who worked for William Morrow. And, of course, I think that he wanted in my pantyhose, but that's okay. But when I told him that I was writing a book, it was like, you hear this very, very often, it's like, pat you on the head, yes, sweetheart, go ahead. But when I said, well, it's done, what do I do with it? And what he did is he had the name of a freelance editor in New York. Mm-hmm. And she was also this drop-dead, skinny, gorgeous model, anyway. She read it, and what she had, which at that time, publishing was a black hole. Everybody knows everything now. Everything. You want numbers, you got them with a finger click. You know everybody who's at every house. But then it was mysterious. It was the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. But she knew the editors for whatever genre you were doing. And the top editor for Regency Romances, at that time, it was Signet. Remember Signet? It no longer, yeah. And it was Signet, and they were the class act in Regency Romances at that time. And she knew the top editor. And that's where you ask, who can help me? Who can help me? Well, will you go to bed with me if I don't? Well, no, I won't go. Let's try somebody else. You know, I mean, you just keep asking and you will find out what you need to know. And that's really the message, guys. You got to have talent. It's got to be bred in the bone, I think. You can be taught a lot of things, but you can't be taught talent. So say you have talent. You add to that tremendous. And if you're a writer, you got to read your brains out. Read everything, because everything is grist for the mill. And then you've got to be disciplined. And this is true in any walk of life where you want to succeed in doing something, you have to be disciplined or hang it up. I don't want to talk to you. Just go away. And then you got to be lucky, like I think I was lucky. You got to be at the right place at the right time. So I think of all those, probably the most important after being a good storyteller and having this raw talent is you got to be disciplined. You got to put in the hours. You're your own boss. There ain't nobody to tell you what to do. You got to do it yourself. Okay? Does everybody now feel, is everybody now a Christian? Let me do it. I can do it. If anybody cared, that's what I would say to any budding writers out there. Anybody who does anything, if you're an artist of any kind or if you whatever you want to do, you know how important it is to be disciplined. That's really the key.
I have a question. I'm not sure if my memory is correct, but I thought your first contemporaries was when you wrote two books for Silhouette Intimate Moments way back in the day.
Oh, good heavens. You are totally right. They were three short contemporary romances, and they came to me on a train in Switzerland. Boy, I got to travel more. And again, I said, I don't know what to do with you. So I called friends, What do I do with this? What do I do with this? And I met somebody who was the big writer for, I guess it was Special Edition at that point. It wasn't Harlequin, it was somebody, I can't remember the name of the house. And she said, okay, this is what you do. Boom, 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 boom. You do it. And yeah, they did three of them. And I still know that editor, and I see her once a year in New York. Yeah, I forgot all about them. And they keep reprinting them and reprinting them, putting on new covers, and manna from heaven. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord. That's another mailbox thing.
Hi, you talked about pacing in your, I think, when you were transitioning into writing suspense, and I was curious, how did you learn how to pace? Was that something that came naturally to you, or what? How did you build that skill?
It came naturally. It did. It was a matter of focus at that point. I was telling Lori about an excellent writer friend of mine who could not do it. It wasn't her thing. It wasn't her forte at all. But it was kind of natural, but of course you need to focus on it. Now, could I make this sharper? Could I make this sharper? Could I make it faster, tighter? Really, boom, boom, boom. And so you do that automatically. You start doing it. And the more suspense that you write, then the more you focus on it, you know, to get the cliffhangers into. I also started something I think is very, very important that I like, and I've gotten so much feedback about it, positive, and that is short chapters. Basically, one scene is one chapter, because people have OCD, and I cannot tell you how many people have told me, I just love it, it's just like this, boom, boom, boom.
I would imagine, though, that you had read a fair number of thrillers before you started writing them.
Yeah.
I think some of us learn how to do things by reading and don't really know what we're doing. I remember one of my early things, I thought I had done something really clever and then discovered it was called foreshadowing and everyone did it. And I thought,
Lori, what is foreshadowing?
It's okay, Catherine, you do it. I think we have time for one last question. Do we have anyone on
the side? Come on, you guys.
This side of the room, the dark chocolate side of the room, is really letting us down.
Let's have the milk chocolate.
The milk chocolate people are clearly winning the questions.
I am a dark chocolate person.
Okay.
But I have a confession to make. I have read all of Lori King's books. Catherine, I have never read one of yours, and I am so excited about reading them now. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Very good. So I think that we need to end this. It's just about 11:15. We will be signing out there for a bit. Do come by the Mystery Writers of America booth and this afternoon. I will just say that I am hoping that Catherine will go on to plot many books powered by milk chocolate. This is New York milk chocolate. And, you know, if indeed her plots are driven by milk chocolate, this will get her through at least one. So thank you all for coming, and
thank you very much.
Have a good fest.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.